the world before Noah and the flood, Sodom, Egypt and the Exodus, Jericho, the northern kingdom of Israel, the southern kingdom of Judah, Babylon, the ancient Babylon, Jerusalem around 70 AD, the Babylon spoken of in Revelation, and this world itself. What might be the common thread that runs through them all? God's judgment was and is handed down against all of them. There are also places, nations, and systems of belief. And so I believe these point to a prevailing pattern in the Bible as it describes how and what God judges. From these, I see that God hands judgment down against places and groups of peoples and against systems of belief. And what is also noteworthy is that in all of these cases, God has also provided and does provide ample warnings that destruction is going to come to them. And it's also important to emphasize that any and all could escape the judgment if they choose to believe the God who gave the warnings and employ the means of escape provided them. For example, before the great flood, God provided Noah and the ark. However, it's only recorded that Noah's immediate family heeded the warnings and were saved. God sent messengers to Sodom with a message to flee the city. However, only Lot, his daughters, and his wife escaped the city. However, Lot's wife, who believed at least somewhat initially the warnings and escaped, turned back and lost that salvation. Moses and Aaron gave both the Egyptians and Israelites warnings leading up to the Exodus. The Israelites and some of the Egyptians did believe and were spared. The citizens of Jericho had ample time to leave the city. Did any leave? Well, the records don't say. But Rahab and probably many of her family and likely friends were saved because they believed in the means of salvation provided them for those that stayed in the city. The northern kingdom of Israel had ample warnings from the prophets, but corporately as a nation, they chose to disregard the means of salvation and were conquered by the Assyrians. The southern kingdom of Judah also received ample warnings. Some of the kings did heed the warnings, and temporary respite followed. But as soon as the faithful kings died, the people once again chose to turn back and reject the salvation that they enjoyed for a time. And eventually, Babylon conquered Judah. Babylon itself received the warnings through Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel, and even through Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Nebuchadnezzar himself appeared to heed the warnings. A few kings later, Belshazzar did not. And so Babylon was conquered by the Medes and the Persians. Jesus himself gave warnings about Jerusalem of his day, and history shows that the Christians who heeded Jesus' warning escaped the destruction that came upon that city. Jesus warns of coming judgment upon spiritual Babylon in Revelation, and Jesus warns of coming judgment upon this world and the systems that belong to this world. This morning, we're going to be looking into the story of Belshazzar's folly, recorded in Daniel 5. I believe this story gives us key insight into how judgment fits into God's works. The story tells us everything I think we need to know and understand to escape judgment and to guide others out of the path of destruction. It's Daniel 5. You know, it's a story, it's a narrative. And I'm going to just get to the punchline here. Verse 23 is the key. It's the key turning point, or the key theme of this chapter, especially the last part. But the God in whose hand is your breath and whose are all your ways, you have not honored. This whole chapter is about honoring God, or not honoring Him. So let's start with verse 1. Sets the setting. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of 1,000. The Medes and Persians were outside the city walls. And here, you know, Belshazzar is throwing a big party. He is supremely confident in himself. He's showing contempt for all the enemies that surround him. He's trusting in the walls of the city. Verse 2. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Verse 1, Belshazzar showed contempt for men. Here, Belshazzar shows contempt for God. Seems almost ironic that, you know, these vessels dedicated to the God of Israel, the God of Judah, the idea there is that, you know, because they're dedicated, they somehow belong to God. And in a sense, in their belief, there's a presence of God associated with them. And now Belshazzar is bringing that into his party. So it shouldn't be surprising that God would pronounce judgment. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Verses 2 through 4 speaks of honor, but in this case, speaking of honoring the wrong things. Belshazzar here is honoring the material things, the things that do not think, that have no power. It's worshiping the wrong gods. In fact, you might say he's challenging the true God by the use and the desecration of these vessels that were dedicated to Yahweh. Verse 5, immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed and his color changed and his lords were perplexed. Here's a warning in the immediate context of the story. The warning is given. Judgment. The lampstand, why is that little detail given? Well, I think it's significant because a lampstand represents, in the Bible, a guide, a spirit, particularly the Holy Spirit. It represents kind of the omnipresence of God. Then it also represents the continuing rule of earthly rulers. Now, in the Israelite sanctuary, opposite the lampstand was the bread of presence, the table containing table with the bread of presence on top, wine and incense. So together, this lampstand represents God's presence. And I think Daniel includes that detail to show us and shows readers that God's presence was there, and it is God's presence that began to write on the wall. Verse 10 begins a little partial telling of the history of Babylon. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, okay, this queen, some translations may use queen mother, she was probably the grandmother of Belshazzar, the daughter of King Nebuchadnezzar. And so the queen declared, O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. Now she's trying to give assurance, even though it's going to turn out to be false. And there's a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. Note that word, holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, as an ancestor, not directly your father the king made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, because an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. Reading through this, it just struck me, again, the similarity of Daniel's Babylonian name, Belteshazzar, to the king's name, Belshazzar. Bel, of course, is the Babylonian supreme deity. Belteshazzar, Daniel's name, means Bel, protect the king. Belshazzar, the king's name, means Bel has protected his life. Just find it quite ironic that, as it turns out in the story, Bel is unable to protect. Verse 13. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, you are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king my father brought from Judah. I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you. Notice the absence of spirit of the holy gods, which his grandmother included. I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Belshazzar thinks he's in charge. You know, he thinks he's the one who can raise up rulers and bring them down. And he doesn't really believe what has been said of Daniel. I think there is very much a tone of contempt for Daniel as God's messenger in his statements made here. And so, Daniel comes in. And he says to the king, and he tells the rest of the story, of Nebuchadnezzar. Let your gift be for yourself, and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king, and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. Daniel is correcting Belshazzar's belief about who's in control here. Okay, it's not Belshazzar who's in control, it's the God of heaven, the Most High God. He gave Nebuchadnezzar power, and the implication is, he gave you, O Belshazzar, your power. Verse 19, and because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed, and whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit was hardened, so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. That's the history. Now comes the indictment. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. But you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of his house have been brought in before you. And you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know. But the God in whose hand is your breath, in whose are all your ways, you have not honored. Belshazzar knew, or should have known, about the true God. After all, he was only a couple generations removed from Nebuchadnezzar. But he had failed to heed the warnings. The dream of Nebuchadnezzar was quite clear. The rule of Babylon would come to an end. Was a matter of when. As long as the kings of Babylon kept faithful to the true God, the kingdom would prosper. But when they failed to do that, the kingdom would come to an end. And Belshazzar should have known that. In fact, Daniel says he had known that. But he had failed to heed the warnings there. And so this judgment that was already pronounced upon the kingdom was about to pass, come to pass. And so 24, we get back to the writing on the wall, the pronouncement, actually the execution of judgment. And then from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed, Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parsin. And this is the interpretation of the matter, Mene. And God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. And at this point, even though the kingdom was lost, I believe that Belshazzar himself still had the opportunity to turn to the true God. But he doesn't. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple. A chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. Belshazzar still believes he's in control, at least he wants to remain in control. And so he goes about his kingly duties. You know, he keeps his promise there of making Daniel the third ruler. I'm not sure Daniel would have really liked that. No. Here Daniel knows that this kingdom is about to end in a couple hours' time. But it happens. And that very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius, the Mede, received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. The chapter begins with a setting and ends with a new setting. Honor and worship, the central theme of this chapter, as well as the entire book of Daniel. It's what it's really about. What does it mean to give God honor, to give God worship? And I believe that it means to acknowledge that I am subject to God's rule over my life, and that I live in accordance to God's rule. Now this is the other side of the faith coin. Believing God's claims is one side of the coin. Acting upon His claims is the other. And this is Belshazzar's failure. This was the escape pod. This is the escape pod that leads us away from God's predetermined places of judgment. But I also believe that this whole who rules my life question, this is why many choose death over life. Because many simply don't want to let go of their desire and their want of controlling their own lives. Many simply, they don't want anyone else to have a say in how their lives are run. So Belshazzar, even though he was given a warning, he chose to remain under judgment. He refused to leave. And I believe that all of God's instructions come down to basically three words. Believe my words. The New Testament helps us understand what God's word is. It's to believe in Jesus. But what exactly does that mean? It's more than just mental assent and agreement with what Jesus says. It's also acting in harmony with that agreement. And that's about faith, once again. Faith is responding to God's faithfulness to us by placing our complete trust and dependence upon God's faithfulness. And trust and dependence in God is shown through our continuous honoring and continuous worship of God. And this, I believe, has always been the issue when it comes to judgment. Who do you ultimately honor and worship? Judgment was already declared against sin and all that represents it. We read that last week in John chapter 12. Satan was cast down. The prince of the world was judged. Sin is already judged. Now, I've heard it that sin is love. Sin is love. There are two types of love. Love that seeks to give and love that seeks to get. The latter kind, the love that seeks to get, is sin. What desires motivate a person? What kind of motivations do you have? What kind of motivations do you want to have? Do you want to give or do you want to get? I believe God's kingdom is all about giving. On the other hand, this world's kingdoms and this world's systems are all about getting. And so I also believe that anyone whose desires are about getting to satisfy self, I do believe would hate to be in God's kingdom. They would grate at the kind of love God embodies and the love that His kingdom manifests. So I believe that many, when it really comes down to it, when they actually get to know who God is, will in fact reject God. Not because God isn't love, because they hate the kind of love God represents. On the other hand, if a person's desire is to give, they'll be perfectly at home with God and in His kingdom. And on this earth, even though this desire to give is imperfect, because we all have sinful tendencies, we have bad habits, I do believe that this desire is sufficient to assure a place, a person a place with God in His kingdom. And Jesus said, wherever your treasure is, there the desires of your heart will also be. I think the opposite is also true. A corollary. Wherever the desire of your heart is, there your treasure will be also be. So do you want to be with God whose love means He always seeks to give and to serve? And do you want to live in His kingdom where honoring and worshiping Him means giving and serving others? And do you want to live forever where there is no room for the selfish kind of love? I believe that these are the judgment and escape questions. And many, I believe, will choose God's kind of love. But as I said, I also believe that many others simply will not give up the selfish love to embrace God's kind of love. And the two cannot coexist. And so people who choose the selfish love, they choose to remain under the places of God's judgment. And when we tell others about God's love and His kingdom, you know, I do believe that we need to clearly inform them about the kind of God and the kind of love and the kind of kingdom that they're being invited to join. Anything less or anything different, at least in my opinion, ought to be grounds for Christian malpractice. And I think that all of our doctrines, all of our baptismal vows, could and maybe even should be summed up by this one question. Do you want to live forever with God in a kingdom where everyone's motivation, including God's and yours, is selfless love, and whose desires and goals are to give and serve more each day?